Welcome to the OrthoClips podcast series, where we're going to discuss the latest hot topics and high-impact papers in orthopedic surgery. I'm your host, Saqib Rahman. Let's get this episode started. Okay, hi, and welcome to the OrthoClips podcast series. And today, we're going to be talking about something a little bit different, but it really affects orthopedic surgeons out there. Hopefully, you're going to learn about something today if you haven't heard about this. And with me, I have two esteemed guests. I have Dr. Catherine Woosley, who's Associate Professor of Orthopedic Surgery and Teaching Faculty and Division Head of Hand and Nerve Surgery at the Cooper Medical School in Camden, New Jersey. I also have with me Dr. Asif Ilyas, who is president of the Rothman Opioid Foundation and a partner and fellowship director at Rothman Orthopedic Surgery in Philadelphia. He's also a professor, vice chair, and associate dean at Drexel University, also in Philadelphia. And they were both co-chairs of a recent meeting last weekend put on by the Rothman Opioid Foundation, a symposium entitled The Next Chapter of the Opioid Epidemic, the Xylazine Crisis. And that's what we're going to be talking about today. So our episode today is the Xylazine Crisis, Orthopedics on the Front Line of an Evolving Epidemic. So thank you guys both for coming on the podcast.
Our pleasure.
Thanks for having us.
Kate, maybe you want to start off and tell our listeners maybe a brief story of one of your first patient encounters with this. What was your clinical impression? What was your differential? And just trying to sort of, I guess, a lot of docs listening to this haven't seen this. So if you're seeing it for the first time, what's going to be going through their mind? What was going through your mind?
Sure. So the first patient I saw with this was during peak COVID. I was actually on maternity leave when COVID happened in March, and this was when I returned in June of 2020. It was a young Caucasian male. He was in his early 30s. He had a history of IBDU. He also had hepatitis C and a psychiatric illness, and he was homeless. And he was admitted for multiple scattered lesions of both of his lower extremities and both of his upper extremities. And I remember we were consulted for that, and we weren't sure if it was an infection. However, when I saw it, since it was peak COVID, I wasn't sure if it was a manifestation of COVID. So that was in my differential diagnosis, because the wounds were not, you know, purulent. Like, it wasn't like a standard IBDU, necrotizing soft tissue infection or an abscess. Didn't appear infected at all, but they were really dry. We also thought under differential, like, were these burn wounds? Did the patient, did he overdose and lay on something hot, or like a crack pipe or a hot radiator, and burn himself? So besides COVID, we thought maybe it could be burn wounds, or maybe the patient was just so malnourished and with his HIV that maybe he had wounds that were very poor to heal. So those were three differentials. However, as time went on and we started seeing more of these patients and these wounds, it wasn't until around, I think, 2022 or late 2021, where we physicians started being more aware of xylazine being mixed into the Philadelphia area drug supply. So it was really around that year that we started thinking, okay, like, this is actually a new drug on the scene causing this.
Yeah. So Dr. Ilyas, can you maybe just tell us, like, what is xylazine? Why are we talking about this? And why its presence in the illicit fentanyl supply has become such a critical issue? Then let's talk about, like, what does this have to do with these wounds?
Of course, yeah, of course. And just to echo a couple of things that Kate said, our experience was similar, where a lot of it was just kind of confusing a little bit in terms of what this could be. And the default thought early on is that this is some kind of infection. And so we'll talk about a little more later about treatment. But, you know, I think what one of the big things we we finally learned was it's not a typical type of infection where we got to be really aggressive. I think early on, I can think my first two cases, we were really aggressive surgically in managing these. And I think that's a lot of lessons were learned early by that approach to this and realizing that's not what this is. And it's been really interesting to be kind of learning on the fly, if you will, with these cases about how best to manage them. To answer your question, Saqib, so one of the issues that is central to the ongoing opioid crisis is people who inject drugs. So injecting opioids, specifically and most commonly fentanyl, but other things such as heroin and cocaine, is the central mechanism for this. And so people inject drugs for a high. And in the drug trade market, xylazine is being added to enhance the effect of the injected opioids. And xylazine itself is not FDA approved for humans. It's a medication. It's a sedative used in the veterinary space for veterinary animals, farm animals, typically large farm animals, cows, horses, things like that, animals like that, to be a sedative. And what's important about that is, firstly, it's not safe. It's not been shown to be safe in humans. It's not a typical opioid, so it doesn't respond necessarily to Narcan, which is our first-line agent for when we're trying to deal with someone who's had opioid addiction. And it's being added to it to increase the euphoric effect of the injected opioid. Now, what's the side effect is what we're really dealing with here is because the xylazine is causing these aggressive wounds either at the site of injury or even other sites of the body. And that's been a kind of a confusing thing that we're seeing is initially the problem was assumed to always be right where the injection was being placed. And I think for the most part, that is the case, but we are seeing like kind of these islands, if you will, of lesions or skip lesions or whatever term you want to use, where it's moving to other parts of the body. But essentially, when you inject in that area, a few things are happening in theory. One is a local irritant, so there's some local toxicity, if you will, from the injection itself. Two, it's causing local ischemia, so that it is decreasing blood supply to the area, so any wounds that form or do not heal well. And thirdly, the other issue with it is acidity. There's some acidity related to the injection as well. And the combination of those things and the repetition of the exposure of it is causing these wounds to form. And if you're able to later, if you could kind of share some of these images, it may be helpful for your listeners to kind of see what we're talking about and get a sense of what we're dealing with.
Yeah, for those of you listening on the standard podcast channels, you could go over to the OrthoClips YouTube channel where, you know, we're going to have some images on this episode too.
So one thing that's interesting with xylazine is besides getting these wounds by mechanism of injecting, it's also been found that you can get these wounds by using xylazine intranasally. So by snorting, by smoking, patients are also getting these wounds. And it's been found that xylazine is present in 94% of the fentanyl Philadelphia area drug supply. So that's why Philadelphia is really an epicenter for this crisis.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. In 2024, I feel like I've still, and you may have noticed the same. I mean, you'll maybe be in a meeting and, or maybe you're just out to dinner and you're just like, listen, guys, have you seen? And a lot of people haven't seen what we're seeing. It is somewhat regional, but it's, I can't imagine why it would not at some point, you know, reach other parts of the country or who knows where else in the world. So, you know, it is very alarming. I mean, you know, in the lay press, they're talking, you know, they're talking about sort of like a flesh eating phenomenon happening. And that is kind of what you see. And it's weird. We still don't 100% seem to know what causes it. I mean, it's not like simply like where you inject it, like your skin melts away. Like you said, there's other routes and you still get these effects. So Kate, I mean, what were some of the unique challenges with this? I mean, now it's been a couple of years. When you see a patient like this, what are some of the other challenges beyond just the medical treatment? You know, when you have a patient who comes in with this and looks like their arm's about to fall off.
Sure. There's one of the challenges is that usually these patients don't have social support. In our series of patients, believe it was around 40% were homeless. So a lot of our patients eloped or left the hospital against medical advice while they were being treated for these wounds. They have poor compliance. They had a very high no-show rate in terms of follow-up with the treating providers in the office space. We usually saw these patients in an inpatient setting and the emergency room setting. Our patients are associated with a lot of high-risk surgical comorbidities. The majority have hepatitis C. A quarter of them have a psychiatric illness. The majority are tobacco smokers. In the beginning, when we were treating these patients, like Dr. Ilya said, we were very aggressive with our surgical management, a lot of debridements. We did reconstruction surgeries, like flap coverage, and, you know,
following general orthopedic principles, right? I mean,
yeah. Because, you know, we are like
surgical principles,
right? Because we were afraid, is this a necrotizing infection? Are they going to, you know, are they going to have a high mortality if we don't act right away surgically? And we actually found in our patients that the mortality rate from the wound itself while they're in the hospital was 0%. Unfortunately, we also had a very high surgical complication rate, like in the 60% range. And we think that's because of their comorbidities, because unfortunately, the majority relapsed on drug use in their immediate post-op period as well. And a good amount of them were lost to follow-up. So we found that having really good addiction medicine treatment, as well as compliance with their addiction medicine treatment, was the main key to successfully starting the wounds to heal.
Now, you both, as I mentioned at the opening, you both recently co-chaired a regional symposium that was entitled The Next Chapter of the Opioid Epidemic, the Xylazine Crisis. And of course, that's what we're talking about today. And maybe Dr. Ilyas, you can maybe just share some of the key takeaways or strategies discussed for managing, you know, both the medical and surgical implications of this crisis. I mean, you had a lot of, maybe you could just tell us who were the participants at this meeting. It was quite a collaborative type of event, and some of the key takeaways. I mean, we're already hearing from one center what their experience is, but we heard from a lot of other centers too.
Yeah, a couple comments, and I think just comment on one thing Kate said, which speaks right to why we did the symposium. One of the things we learned early on in terms of managing this problem is that it's not singularly a surgical problem. And obviously, people came in with these really aggressive wounds. We were on the extremities, so obviously, we were contacted as orthopedic surgeons. We deal with limb wounds and infections and what have you. So it made sense. And oftentimes, beyond that, these wounds would be very aggressive, but they would go beyond the skin, sub-Q fascia, down to muscle, through tendon, down to bone. And for all those reasons, orthopedics and other reconstructive surgeries were routinely consulted. So we were right in the thick of this. But what we learned early is that we're not going to be able to operate ourselves out of these problems. So we needed the help of addiction medicine. We needed the help of social services to manage these patients, because they would have a high, as Kate said, a high elopement rate, because we often couldn't manage their addiction. And when you have an addiction, you know, you're going to return to satisfy that addiction, fortunately. And one of the things that really, the first realizations I came to beyond in realizing it's not just an infection and that, like I said, we can't operate our way out of this, is to respect the power of addiction. It is so powerful. And as non-addiction medicine health professionals, I didn't fully appreciate the power of the addiction, where it was so strong that despite these often grotesque wounds and debilitating wounds that were often even self-amputating, people kept doing it. And people would then lose one limb and then proceed to inject in another limb and then compromise that limb. And it's not to be funny or to ridicule it, but to appreciate the power of that addiction. That's what we realized early. So the symposium that you referenced was organized by the Roth and Opiate Foundation in recognition of this ongoing issue that is not at this time occurring proportionally across either Philadelphia or Pennsylvania or the country, but we recognize as being at busy level one academic trauma centers in urban areas that unfortunately it's probably going to increase across sites, because oftentimes these type of issues do have a propensity to occur in Philadelphia. Philadelphia is unfortunately known among many things to have a fairly robust drug trade business and site, and it's actually a big drug tourism site, unfortunately, for people as well. So we were seeing these because of that, and we realized that we need to bring people together in the city to talk about this from their different perspectives. Is one academic center having a different experience than others? Is one surgical team managing differently than others? Is one addiction medicine team managing this differently than others? So the Roth and Opiate Foundation is a 501c3 nonprofit organization dedicated to challenging and fighting the opioid crisis, be it through research, education, or advocacy. So this was one of our initiatives. So we brought professionals from all over the city. So we had folks from, we hosted it at Jefferson. We had folks like Kate from Cooper, Temple, where you're from, Penn, Drexel, I'm blanking a couple other places up top of my head, Einstein, et cetera. And I've got their perspectives on it. And frankly, I learned quite a lot. We had a very ambitious agenda trying to cover a lot of ground in it. But I think we really learned a lot in terms of best practices, learning each other's algorithms, learning each other's workflows, and just getting a better sense of the problem in front of us.
Okay, great. You know, I guess to summarize, I think I want to reach out to, you know, orthopedic surgeons, you know, elsewhere in the USA and globally for that matter, who haven't necessarily encountered these, you know, cases of these sort of horrific xylazine related wounds with tissue necrosis. Let's maybe sum up, let's sum up the findings from the meeting, because this is probably, you know, I was at the meeting too. I learned a lot as well. And I think as sort of an epicenter for this, let's maybe summarize what were the surgical take-home points, you know, what to do, what not to do, you know, and thinking about just simple debridement, wound care, when to do a flap, when not to do a flap, and then what are the sort of, you know, medical aspects of the care. And we've touched on all of this, but just to kind of sum up, what were those surgical and medical take-home points, what to do and what not to do? I don't know, Kate, if you want to start.
Sure. I think that the take-home points, which seem to be a consensus across all the hospital healthcare systems surgeons that presented, is now the trend is not to rush the patient to the operating room. Addiction medicine, they are involved from the very start to manage the patient's withdrawal, also to manage the patient's pain. These patients require a tremendous amount of pain medications to keep them in the hospital to prevent their withdrawal from happening. And wound care is now the first treatment line. And with wound care, you know, you can do debridement, but, you know, it's enzymatic debridement. So for example, clean the wound with, you know, warm water and a bacterial soap, and then apply silvadine to the wound. And that can give some nice enzymatic debridement to the wound, and then you apply, you know, usually a Vaseline-based ointment on top of the wound after that, and then a dressing that's non-occlusive and not really tight. And nursing can do that for the patients. But the surgery intervention at this point is really if there's no hand function whatsoever, and if the wound is so bad that it's gone through all levels of tissue, including the bone. And, you know, usually that means there's osteomyelitis. There can be, you know, significant bone loss, and there's basically a structural loss of the limb, and the arm is about to auto-amputate itself. So in those scenarios, that's when us surgeons are now doing amputations for the patients. I will say anecdotally that with my patients I've amputated, unfortunately, half of them have started injecting into their amputation site postoperatively. And I'm seeing this in follow-up in terms of when the patients come to the emergency room, because like I mentioned, I have really poor follow-up post-op with my patients in the office. But, you know, they come in the emergency room, and with EMR, the photos are always uploaded. So sadly, even an amputation doesn't stop the patients from continued drug use.
One of the key surgical things I heard from the meeting, and certainly, you know, at Temple, we've been at the center of this as well, is if you're really considering major surgery and it's not a critical area, meaning someone who's going to bleed out, like, so an extremity, I would say, and for the most part, not critical areas, that if you can, if they're not off of the drugs for like at least 6 weeks and in a program, then you probably should really hold off on doing any major surgery. I mean, like you're saying, you're even doing a definitive amputation for someone's arm is about to fall off. And if they're not coming off the drugs, there's a higher chance of a problem. So I think one of the keys I heard was getting on top of the withdrawal, getting addiction medicine involved. And there are some patients who potentially will be able to come off the drugs. And I think if that's the case, then you're going to have a much better chance at recovery. And if surgery is being contemplated, it might be more successful. The other thing I do remember hearing surgically was that you don't, like you said, this is goes against our normal surgical principles for aggressive treatment. You're not going in there and doing free flaps and stuff like that for this. But if it's a critical area, and there were some cases where it's like right over the great vessels or right in the groin or somewhere where they're going to bleed out, if another cell dies, then sometimes a flap might be needed. So,
yeah.
And also, if you want to add to other take-home points we missed.
Yeah, I would just add the following, just to build on what you and Kate said, is a couple of things. So I think in terms of surgery, and since, you know, we're surgeons and the audience for this is surgeons, is number one, these do not need to go right to the operating room. These are not, it's not a necrotizing fasciitis. In Kate's series that we recently submitted, it was accepted for publication, it was like a 0% mortality from these wounds. Even though they can look horrific, it's a local effect. So I think it's really important for surgeons to know that firstly, and then to make sure any treatment they do is in conjunction with addiction medicine, because their need for opioids during their hospital course is impressive. The hundreds of milligrams per day that they're going to need of oxycodone or other agents that most of us are not comfortable writing for, in order to just keep them at a level that they don't go into withdrawal and stay for treatment. So that's the first thing. In terms of the surgical tree, it's a little bit different. So like Kate said, number one, it's mostly in the beginning. You can do bedside wound management from VACs, local enzymatic stuff. You don't have to do a surgical debridement. When you go to the OR, you can start to debride as your first step in the OR. Before you then graduate to the next level, which would be something either skin grafts or flaps, that's where you mentioned that once you start doing those type of procedures, you really have to make sure that they are showing compliance with their addiction medicine treatment, because now you're starting to take tissue from someplace else to put it there. So now you have donor site issues. You have to start thinking about, it's a more expensive surgery. There's more rehab. There's more wound care. They need to be more responsible with their post-operative management for that flap or graft case to survive. So you really have to make sure that they are ready to manage that. And that means that they're showing compliance, their addiction medicine treatment. And then unfortunately, some cases do need an amputation. And I'm going to plug a paper that Kate and I wrote recently that I'm going to share with you, Saqib. If you can feel free to post it with your posting of this episode, because of Open Access Journal, it's the first of its kind in terms of talking about a treatment algorithm. And one of the things we talk about in this algorithm is, as you graduate to these more complex reconstructive procedures, is the compliance issue that you and I both mentioned. But also, if you have to consider amputation, there's two things to take into consideration amongst others. One is whether hand function is maintained or not, and you really should consider amputation if hand function is not maintained, then that's really your indication. But if it is maintained, then you obviously salvage it. But also that more than one surgeon needs to write in the chart that this patient needs an amputation. You need at least two. And not because we're seeing lawsuits again about this, but I just think that in general, lawsuits tend to occur in areas of, and we're around amputation surgery. And I think you want to be very clear cut in the chart with multiple consultants saying it needs to be done. And in today's EMR, you can readily put pictures in the chart. And I would also recommend surgeons, since we're speaking to them right now, to be generous with putting pictures in the chart of these wounds. to truly characterize them and to protect themselves, in the future if there's an issue to come of it. Not to make this about medical legal issues, but I just think it's smart to do that.
Great
to
tips.
add to add to that, in my practice, if I'm thinking about amputating a xylazine patient, I also have a direct conversation with the addiction medicine physician before, so in terms of do they agree and do they think the timing is appropriate. One question I have that's still looming for me is, what is the appropriate length of time of like a good compliance time point of the patient being in drug remission in terms of offering the patient reconstructive surgery? So, people quote in the literature, is successful drug remission 3 months? Is it shorter than that? Is it longer than that? I've asked addiction medicine. They really can't give me a good time point answer. And I haven't found that in the literature myself. So that's a question that I have moving forward for the future.
Yeah, I think, as we come to the end of this conversation, clearly there's a lot more questions. I think few things are starting to be answered, at least in the things we talked about. But, it's still not clear to me 100% like what exactly is going on. And it's still not clear to me why exactly we're seeing this here. And, it still hasn't quite caught fire elsewhere, but I don't see any reason why it wouldn't. Yeah, a lot of management questions, I think, still remain. So I think there's a lot of research to be done. And one thing that scares me is that even if, there's been political action to try and limit the supply of this, other similar medications or drugs are right around the corner that could just take its place. So I think ultimately it seems that problems like this could remain a challenge or get worse as they spread. So I think it's important to inform everybody. So I want to thank you guys both for taking your time to talk to us about this today. Again, we've been talking with Dr. Catherine Woosley and Dr. Asif Ilyas on the xylazine crisis, orthopedics on the front line of an evolving epidemic. Thank you both again for being on the podcast today.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Thanks, Doc. Appreciate it.
After we concluded our interview, I had a few thoughts to make. One, the wounds want to heal for the most part. And if you give it a chance and if they get the proper wound care, you can be really surprised how some really terrible wounds can, with time, heal. Don't do grafts. And you may have a wound that looks like it's ready for a graft, but if they're still injecting, you can make it worse. You could potentially take a problem, seal it off, and create the opportunity for a deep abscess or infection. So, and then a true necrotizing soft tissue infection. So, but if your patient is able to come off of the IV drugs, then you can at some point consider skin graft substitutes, for example, and they can really help. Lastly, and we already talked about this, addiction is powerful. Try not to be judgmental as a treating physician. Your patient really does need help getting off the drugs somehow. Addiction medicine definitely can help. Getting family involved, if possible, can sometimes really make a difference. So don't forget about that. And ultimately, try not to sensationalize or act shocked. These are terrible wounds. Recognize that. Sure. Document, take photos to put in the chart. That's absolutely important. But you don't want to act shocked. You don't want to say, hey, everybody, come take a look at this wound. The patients know it. They're embarrassed enough as it is. So there's no need to sensationalize anymore. And with the appropriate care, and hopefully we'll learn more how to best treat these wounds can heal and we can avoid amputations and some of the more severe complications we are seeing from these really terrible wounds. So thanks, and see you on the next episode.